Okay, so today I'm going to have a brief, well, today I'm going to have a chat with Nathaniel Lucas. He's the Australian author of the book For My People, which is a compendium of poetry offering some truly excellent poems and turns of phrase. I found them pretty refreshing and revealing in their use of language, neglected terminology, and the erudite descriptions of our interior and exterior worlds. For My People was released on the 27th of August this year, and it's available from Amazon. So Nathaniel's also on Twitter as @NatLucas1788. So welcome to the show, Nathaniel.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, thanks so much for coming on. We saw that you posted a sort of interesting poem about or inspired by BAPS, a Bronze Age pervert. And in the context of our fourth episode where we covered Bronze Age mindset, we thought the poem was pretty cool and looked into some of your other work. Would you mind giving us a reading of that poem and maybe the title and a bit of background?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, obviously I'm just desperate for a retweet on Twitter, which is probably most of the impetus for this poem. But, yeah, it's based on a true story of, I was probably like a lot of us young guys, I was a bit of a rat bag in high school, and I didn't really do anything too crazy, but I had this friend, and we would do things like go exploring in the storm drains near our house and, graffiti up some walls that no one could see and things like that. And one of the things we did was we climbed up this hill near a freeway on-ramp. And it used to be a cow pasture, but it had all dried up and there was really nothing there, but there was all fenced in and whatever. And we made a flag out of a towel and hiked up to the top of this hill. It was only 10, 15 minutes or so, and planted this flag at the top of the hill. And I didn't have any kind of theoretical awareness of what that might symbolize. It was just kind of a way to pass the time. But in hindsight, it seems like a kind of small act of unconscious rebellion. So yeah, that the memory of that and BAPS' concept of owned space, which I find very compelling in his book. For those who've read the book, it's this idea that there's nowhere left to explore, right? Everything that's around us is already owned, so and you can't own it, and that's why we have such a big focus on space travel, which is, personally I'm not very optimistic about. I don't think that's really an answer to anything, but I understand the appeal of it as an outlet for exploration. So this is it. Do you want me to read this out?
Yeah, please.
So this is called Owned Space, a sonnet for BAP. At the bottom of the hill, you stand at the fence, while vehicular yeast flows past. The sun is high. You throw your bag over the barbed wire pretense and stoop between the lines. What slows is time. Halfway up, the bees oscillate between drone and whine. You have disturbed their ways. Are you the first to climb this cracked cone? Statuesque to avoid their sting, you pause and gaze down at the glinting freeways and strawberry fields on either owned side of your new domain. Seasonal pickers under sacred arcs of water yields and silver lines of traffic agitate their closed moraines. You find a stick. With duct tape, you tie your red towel to it, plant it in the peak, and bellow out your open vowel.
That's great. That's really good. It's even better with you reading it.
Thanks. Poetry is definitely meant to be read aloud. In my opinion, if it's not, then it's not really poetry.
But. No, I'll back that. Bring back the orator gang, you know?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It's one of those great traditions of, you know, blokey-ish stuff and bush poetry, at least in Australia, that I've always really admired, as those blokes that could recite, you know, banjo from memory, or they had a couple of poems up their sleeve and things. And yeah, it's fantastic. I think it's something that's certainly, there's a lot lost if you're just reading it from the text, but hearing it from the author themselves, that's, yeah, it's great.
Also,
I really love the imagery. Go on.
The way of recontextualizing, the way of just messing around in high school through Bap's lens is pretty interesting. Really does recapture that, the spirit of doing that sort of thing. Because I'd imagine that nearly every high school kid does it at some point, like trying to claim something in that way.
Yeah, well, I think it's just instinctive. Well, in males, definitely.
Mm. Yeah, and there's Bap's calls about, you know, young boys needing, or young men needing, the space to form gangs and build forts and that kind of stuff. And I was reminded of that from your writing and your description of what inspired it. So,
yeah.
Go on.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was gonna, but then this idea of own space means that you have that instinct, but any way that you express it is going to be acting out.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. Or considered to be.
Needs to be. Yeah, or considered to be acting out. I mean, there needs to be healthy ways of doing this.
Mm. Yeah. So you've very kindly offered a bit more of your time, and we're going to, I guess, go through a bit of an interview of sorts and have a chat about your work and some of the other poems in your book. So I'll just start out. The title of the book is For My People, and I believe that's the name of the first poem, or at least maybe the introduction in the book. So who were you writing? Yeah, who are my people? Who are you referring to?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. I mean, in my case, I would say Anglo-Australians and I suppose Anglo people all over the world. That's what I would consider to be my main identification.
Mm.
And the reason that phrase, because that phrase to me, I can even remember very specifically the first time I ever heard someone say that out loud, or something along the lines of you know, our people.
Mm-hmm.
And that had never, you know, growing up, like, that had never even occurred to me, right? That that was even something that I could think. And it was one of the first kind of in real life things that I went to, which I highly recommend that people do if it's at all possible. Been a very positive experience for me to meet people in real life.
Mm.
But yeah, I guess that phrase really resonates with me. And then also there's a poem by Margaret Walker, who is an African American poet quite famous in America, and she has had a poem called For My People, and one day I read it and why don't I write one for us? Because, you know, in some ways it may not seem like it on the surface, but, you know, we have a lot of problems at the moment. And really the style of that poem, For My People, is actually in the style of that Margaret Walker poem. And I've actually acknowledged her because I felt like I kind of had to. I was like, well, I'm basically, the first stanza is like almost a... could be considered plagiarizing her her poem, but the rest of it's obviously very different.
Mm.
So I just acknowledge that, and it's, you know, her thing is kind of a lament for you know, African Americans in the 1960s or whatever.
Mm.
But yeah, you know, and also I see I meet a lot of younger people who have very little awareness of their own history and very little sense of their own identity outside of themselves.
Mm.
or maybe the things they do, or maybe the politics they have, or something like that, but they don't seem to have any kind of awareness, and many I'm sure you guys have seen this too, you know, they'll say things like, I hate white people. Oh, I wish I wasn't Anglo or whatever. I wish I wasn't white, you know. Oh, Australia, Australia is so terrible. Australia is such a bad place, you know, whatever. And so, I've talked about this with a lot of people. This is what I call the shit lib question, right? Like, these are, they're also us in a way, and they also have very similar qualities. We're very similar, and in the sense that they're willing to, say, forego bourgeois comforts for, like, artistic pursuits, things like that. You know, there's a lot of admirable things about shit libs, really, when you think about it. But they're just oriented in the wrong direction. And so I guess this poem is kind of a very forlorn hope that it might help someone like that to see the kind of bigger picture and to maybe understand that they have a broader identity than, you know, whatever it may be, you know, than that they're vegans or whatever.
Yeah, I think that's definitely.
Does that make sense?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, and it's definitely possible, I believe, to get that from your work. I've got the book myself, and I thoroughly recommend everybody else to go out and get it where you can. You're selling physical copies as well. I got mine as an ebook, which is how I read a lot of things now. So it's available both as ebook and physical copy. Yeah, it's certainly not expensive. I think the paperback is like $10. I think I paid $5 for my ebook.
It's a bit more. I think that's the US dollars price. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
More in Australian dollars, but yeah.
Yeah, right. Well, it's still worth it. And it certainly is really worth it in terms that a couple of the poems that I read, even though they may be, I guess, just short in their textual form, the amount of meaning and the amount of thinking that you can sort of get out of each one. Yeah, it really belies how short they might be. So did you want to talk a little bit about your previous work? So some people, and I think there might be a bit of overlap between our listenership and those people, may know you as Herschel.
Yes, that's right. I was Herschel on the Convict Report for, I think I joined them, I can't remember exactly, something like episode in the 60s or something.
Yeah. Do you want to just give a super short description or crash course of what the Convict Report was, just for listeners that, you know, all both listeners that might not have heard of it?
Yeah, I guess the Convict Report was TRS in Australia, I guess is how you would best describe it. But I think we were, I don't know, we were a bit different. We did do some issues or some episodes about cultural issues. We did a whole thing about Henry Lawson, one episode, which I was really happy about. We did some book reviews, but I guess it was just the basic kind of TRS narrative, except not as, I don't know, not as hardcore as them, I think, in some ways.
Yeah.
Adapted to local conditions. And yeah, we talk a lot about, say, like China, you know, Chinese issues and mass migration and the culture and Aboriginal things and news. We were pretty focused, heavily focused on news week.
And yeah.
We would get massively triggered by, you know, various news stories and just talk about it and banter about it. I hope that's a fair assessment, because I reckon some of the other guys will be listening to this. So I hope they're happy with me saying that.
Yeah, that sounded fair to me. I mean, I mentioned before we started recording, I was a long-term listener. And yeah, the Convict Report was a podcast that went for really quite some time. I think it might have stretched into the years.
I think it was like at least 2.5 years, if not maybe 3. Yeah.
Yeah, and it went down rather suddenly, as a lot of things in the antipodes did. I leave our listeners to fill in the blanks, but it was no small part in inspiring our little podcast that we've got together, and a particular episode on Adjustment Day by Chuck Palahniuk. I really enjoyed that one.
Oh, great. Yeah. Mm. That was a lot of fun. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Did you read the book?
I did. Yeah, I did.
Yeah. What did you think? Did you think we were accurate?
Yeah, I thought you were pretty spot on. Particularly with regard to the sort of Afrofuturism stuff and all of that. I got a lot out of it and a lot out of your analysis. But yeah, I mean, you've kind of blocked us from doing it, so thanks for that. But it was a great...
You can give it a shot.
Yeah, yeah. It's a shame that we can't kind of point people to go and check that episode out, but maybe it'll come back. Who knows?
Who knows? It might be on YouTube somewhere. I think there are still a couple up on YouTube somewhere.
I know, yeah. I know that you can get them. I know they're floating about there, you know. Everything on the internet's forever, I guess. They're floating around there somewhere, so all the back apps of TCR and stuff. But
there's always that one fan that downloads every single episode and will upload here and there.
Mm.
Yeah, I think I know at least one guy like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So our next episode is going to focus on a book called Best We Forget by Peter Cochran. So this book explores the relationship between Australia's involvement in the Great War, so World War One, and the White Australia Policy, or formerly known as the Immigration Restriction Act of 1901. In your poem, April 25, 2015, London, England, you paint a pretty bleak picture of the current state, or perhaps the absolute state of Britain. Could you elaborate on the sentiments of this poem for us, or would you care to maybe provide a reading of some choice sections?
I can elaborate a bit. I mean, again, for a creative writer, I honestly don't have much of an imagination. I was literally there on this day, April 25th, 2015, obviously the 100th year anniversary of Gallipoli, in Westminster. Just as kind of a tourist in London, and yeah, so I was standing on that bridge, looking at Parliament House, you know, London Parliament House, and the kind of juxtaposition, I guess, was quite striking to me. And I don't know. I know I'm not really. I don't know a huge amount about the history, but you know, the decisions that were made there. Who knows if actually Churchill was actually there at the time? I don't know, but you know, symbolically, the decisions that were made there put all of these Australian men on the front lines, and yeah, just a very whether that was a good military decision or even a moral decision, I don't really know, but yeah, it was very striking. And then I was considering the state of. Yeah, I couldn't help thinking about, well, would I be capable of doing that myself, of being there? And obviously the conclusion is, well, not really. I mean, can you imagine sending in even the Australian military, I think, of today into a situation like that? Like, we're just not the same men. And I think you guys have touched on this when you were talking about Evola, you know, like... We're like even the best of us really is like 10% of the man that one of these men was, you know, in terms of courage and physical ability and all of that. I mean, that's my opinion anyway. I'll give it a read if you want.
Please, yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah. So this is called April 25, 2015, London, England. Another pulsing city day, west of Westminster, 36,500 dawns away. Time's up and no war came for our just as capable men. Blood retained can still distribute blame. War-age boys wish for war, weep at remembrance news, perish quickening views, reflect on why brutal rich mute undone civilians spar. March past Australia House, compare return flights, lunch alone in Temple Bar. Then return to archives. Ovum England, give us strength. since no war came for these, our just and capable men.
I think the second last and the third last stanzas, the stanza that closed with lunch alone at Temple Bar, those both really struck me, like the powerful imagery of the feelings of solitude, 100 years hence, internal, I guess, feelings of solitude, and also the, I can't remember if you could go back to the stanza where it's sort of, you know, wishing for war and remembrance.
Yeah.
I see, I've got it in front of me.
War age boys wish for war. So,
yeah. Weep at remembrance news, perish quickening views, reflect on my brutal rich. It was struck too by the sort of truncated language. It really added, I guess, to the feeling of confusion that a lot of us might have had as we were younger and, you know, around those sort of times, and in remembering the Anzac struggle and trying to contextualize it in our own experience.
Yeah, and I think also there's a real sense of younger men kind of maybe subconsciously or maybe even consciously kind of wanting a fight, like wanting wanting war in some way. And it's not available to them, really, even symbolically or metaphorically. You know, there's like what's the struggle, right?
Yeah. So I was thinking after that, and in reading lots of other poems in the book, you know, there's some really interesting use of language there, lots of neglected terminology, and, you know, I had to reach for the dictionary more than a couple of times. But it's really good. I love things like that that improve my vocab and, you know, really not overly florid or, you know, senseless usage of the terms. Often it's to, you know, summarize something or just to communicate something very clear. I was wondering about your background, just because of that vocabulary and the turn of phrase in the book. It made me kind of guess maybe you've had some formal training in the humanities. And by extension, how did you find that experience, if you did?
True. I did undergrad in English and writing. Yeah, and it was a very interesting experience. It kind of did begin, like I had all of the, I guess what you'd expect, you know.
Maybe the right attitudes, yeah.
Whatever, all of that, not all the professors, which I'll talk about in a second, but, you know, really all I had to do to keep me on the reservation, so to speak, is just not denigrate people like Joseph Conrad, you know, don't teach that they're, you know, subhumans who shouldn't be read, basically. Like, that's all they had to do. They didn't even have to do much. And I wouldn't have, my views probably wouldn't have changed so drastically, but they just really, they just can't help themselves. I don't know. And I don't know if you have, like, I think you probably know what I'm talking about, but maybe for the audience, like, they're just so, I don't even really know how to explain it, because I'm just kind of in this world, kind of marinated in this world for so long. But, like, you know, everything is racist, everything is sexist. Every European male author is secretly a homosexual, right? You know, is a woman or something, or their wife wrote the books, or, you know, things like that, or their sister wrote the books, or they stole it from someone else, or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And so the example that I always use, which it's kind of a simplified example, but it still is true, is that Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad started really the first, like, international human rights campaign to shut down the Belgian Congo, which was, you know, truly horrific, horrific place, as it was then, as it is now. But this novel was used as a as inspiration to, you know, to reform the place and to take it away from the King of Belgium.
Mm.
And yet when it's taught at universities, you know, Joseph Conrad is a horrific racist, you know, because there are some African characters, you know, screaming and yelling on the banks of the river, and he's perpetuating racial stereotypes, and so like they just can't give him credit for anything, right? And look, like the book didn't kick it off. The book was kind of part of this generalized campaign that like Mark Twain participated in and others, and but you know they just can't, like they can't, you know what I mean, right? They just can't.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think
that. That's all they have. Yeah.
Go on.
Oh, so yeah, and like that's all they had to do. You know, like literally all they had to do was just be somewhat fair-minded.
Mm.
And I wouldn't have gone looking anywhere else. I mean, I love this stuff. You know, I would love nothing more than to be an English professor. You know, but it's just not. I remember Greg Johnson talking about this when I was listening to him once. He's like, yeah, you know, I would have. All I wanted to do was write articles that, you know, 10 other academics would read and be a professor. And he's like, yeah. I would have been delighted with that life. I would have loved it.
Mm.
You know, like, I wouldn't have had any problem with it at all. But instead, they had to, you know, they had to play their little games. And
yeah.
For him, it became clear that he wasn't going to be promoted. He wasn't going to get a job, really. And so he's like, well, I may as well just go all the way. So, you know, I haven't really done that yet, but it's just such a smothered environment for men and for male thinking, really, the humanities. They're just completely feminized, and that's probably the fault of men back in the day. I don't know, you know. Who knows where the real blame for all these things really lies? I'm sure we all have our different ideas, and it's obviously a combination of a lot of things. But currently, anyway, it's basically impossible to be someone like us and to be honest about what you believe and to participate in this world. It's not really possible. Mm.
Oh, it's not just in the humanities; it's across the board. Go, Demarc. Sorry.
Right.
It makes you wonder, all of these people going off about Conrad, if it ever occurs to them that their grave is going to get spat on one day because they're a bit too white or male. Like, it's quite clicked in their head that they're long-term shooting themselves in the foot unless they actually are a black woman.
Yeah. Well,
even then, that won't save you.
No. No, they don't realize that.
Yeah,
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say it's just a little interesting heuristic that you can try with people who have these, you know, pernicious attitudes, maybe bearing out some inferiority complex of their own in council culture and all the rest of it, you know, the purity spiraling. That if you just simply ask them, what's the goal of this? Like, what's the end goal of this project or of this sort of exercise of cancel culture and academia and, you know, broadly cultural censorship, you know, once you've found and rooted out all of the heretics, what's left? What's our goal here? Apart from simply controlling the narrative, is it generative at all? Or is it, pardon?
Well, there's always another heretic. Like, you never, it's like Cambodia, you know, Pol Pot, like you're never going to run out of heretics.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to ask you briefly just if you had any advice for any of our listeners who might be thinking about getting into, you know, maybe not studying the humanities, but, you know, their own creative or literary aspirations. You're a published author, you do very good work. Did you have any sort of basics to get people started?
There are still some good people at universities. I actually wouldn't rule out completely doing university degree, probably not in English, but I think something like creative writing, if you're not so worried about finding a good job straight away after you finish, that would be okay.
Mm.
The creative writing courses that I took and the ones that I've seen since I've graduated have featured a pretty wide range of readings, and it's not really political or ideological. You can still, you can still do things that aren't, you know, you're not so restricted, is what I mean.
Mm.
But really, if you're going to do it, you're going to do it, and I would just read, just follow your interests. I mean, one book leads to another. It's kind of like listening to music when you're in high school, you know, like one band leads to another, and you just kind of keep going. That's what I would do, and I would practice, you know, just practice. Your first work is not going to be your best. It's probably not going to be very good. I've written hundreds and hundreds of poems, and I can remember one that came to me kind of fully formed in and where I just wrote it straight out, and it was done. That's happened once. So go back and revise, look at, write something, and then leave it for as long as you can. I mean, I've finished things like stories and poems that I started even years before, and then gone back and finished them. So yeah, it really needs to be, like, it doesn't need to be your whole life. You need to have a kind of balanced life, but it does need to be something that you just can't get away from. It has to be something that's impulsive. Like, you have to, you know, you have to wake up in the middle of the night, or just before you go to sleep, you have something and you, an idea, and you get up and you write it down. Like, it has to be a compulsion, I think. It's not a compulsion if it's just something that you want to do because you want to do it, or you you think it's cool or something. Like, it's, yeah, I wouldn't do it. But if it is a compulsion, you definitely should. Yeah.
Great.
But just actually, I wanted to say one other thing about the university.
Sure.
Is also the other problem is that they don't really acknowledge any concept of like beauty or literary merit. You know, you can't really say, well, this poem is good because it's beautiful for the following reasons, because of the use of rhyme or the use of rhythm, or the kind of juxtaposition of various words that make you think about those words in a different way. You know, you can't just say it's beautiful, that's not enough, right? In fact, they really, most of them actually don't really believe in the concept of beauty. Of course they do, because you can't avoid it in their daily life. I'm sure they, you know, when they go home and they're no longer a professor, they would pursue things that they find beautiful. But when you're actually looking at a book, you can't say that this is beautiful, and you also can't really say, well, this is better than something else, even though we study the classics because they are better, and because they've been proven to be better over time, and that's why they're a course reader. But you can't say that. It's not part of the, you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
they would say that fact is just a construction of some sort of agenda of some kind of oppressive group or person who is pushing that, and that's the only reason why we read it now, because it's been done in the past, and, you know, blah blah blah.
Any evaluative, any position, statement of value, beauty, hierarchy, anything like that. Yeah, I've seen those targeted myself.
Yeah, and it's just totally absurd, because you have to be an academic to believe something like that.
So getting to a more personal note, the poem in the book, Nathaniel Lucas, so it contains an amazing and pretty heartbreaking historical narrative, I'm assuming, of your namesake. Could you tell us maybe a little bit more about his story and how it's impacted you? It was a cracking read.
Yeah, thanks, man. Obviously, that's not my real name, Nathaniel Lucas, just to be clear, but it is the real name of one of my ancestors, who was a first fleet convict. And I know this because my great aunt wrote a book about our family. She did a lot of research, which I'm extremely grateful for. You know, she's just a kind of a normal lady, you know, born in her time. She didn't do it for any sort of, you know, any sort of weird reason or political reason or anything. But yeah, it's really good and has really given me a very strong sense of Australian identity, because I didn't grow up in Australia, as you can probably tell. But yeah, this particular story about this this man Nathaniel Lucas is there's some question about him potentially being framed for his crime, which was he stole some bed sheets that were then found under his bed by his landlady. But he had skills; he had some carpentry skills, and so there's a suggestion, which I don't know if it's true, but there's this kind of suggestion that they the Navy wanted to use Norfolk Island pines as masts, and so that they tried to find some carpenters who would be able to do that work for him. For them. And he was sent to Norfolk Island straight away. There was, I think they spent 2 weeks in Botany Bay and then got sent to Norfolk Island, a whole group of them. And as it turns out, Norfolk Island pines are useless for masts, but they didn't know that at the time. And so while they were there, he married a convict. I think it was either on the ship or very soon after they landed. And they had 12 kids, but two of them, they had twin daughters who were killed by a tree that he cut down that accidentally fell on their house and killed the two daughters. I think they were 4 years old, and injured some of the other children. And so then he moved back to Sydney with his family and was a kind of apprentice to Francis Greenway, who's the architect. Sydney built a lot of the colonial buildings in Sydney, or designed them, you know, under Governor Macquarie. And so he built the church, the Anglican Church at Liverpool in Sydney, which is still there, and a few other buildings assisted in. But Francis Greenway was a bit of a character. He's a really very interesting character of colonial Sydney. And he had a feud with Nathaniel Lucas. He reckoned that the stone that he was providing wasn't good enough, and, you know, and anyway, yeah, he ended up drowning in the Liverpool River, probably drunk, probably something of an alcoholic, and yeah, that's the story. So I've taken a lot of interest in him as a person. And what he went through, I mean, I guess wrenched out of your familiar life in England, and then you end up on the other side of the world, and you can't really go back.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's. I think the convict heritage is very important for Australia, and I think it's much more important than we probably want to give it credit for. I just finished reading The Fatal Shore by Robert Hughes, which is really, really good. He has some. He has some kind of. He has his liberal biases, you know. But it's the story is really, really good. And yeah, I don't think we've really quite understood how that whole time has influenced us.
No, I think you're right. First and foremost, and also before anything else, like, thanks for sharing that story. It's amazing, you know, and we've said on this show, it's so important to understand your history and to look into these things. Especially as it becomes increasingly perhaps obfuscated by cultural and political phenomena as being more and more inconvenient to the prevailing narrative. Just this, I mean, if you wouldn't mind me butchering one section of the poem.
Go for it, yeah.
Yeah, there's this excellent account towards the end, you know, where it says that freed before his 7 years, at the moment ex-Southampton, Nath supplied grain, meat, materials, built windmills on Sydney's ridges, owned a pub. He drowned, a frothing wreck at Liverpool, drunken on our casual shores a few strokes further from Hackney, buried in the yard of the church he cheated of quality stone. Shame is hardly a shame nowadays, sentences merely sentences, tickets of leave, even tickets of leave. Just that account, you know, of somebody who's just done so much with their lives. And before, as you said, you know, the Norfolk Island Pines fiasco, just a brief shout out to Mick. Every time you mention Norfolk Island, I'm sure he'll get very excited. Big fan, but he couldn't join us today, sadly. He's one of our usual hosts, yeah.
We opened the last one with sport with our Bronzo, and we get right into Norfolk Island without Mick right now. That's the new running theme of this podcast. We just, you know, talk about things people love, but force them to listen and not get involved.
Yeah. But no, I think you're absolutely right about our shared convict heritage and also understanding your own. So yeah, I really appreciate that poem. I'd encourage, again, everyone to go and pick up the book and to read through, because there's plenty, I suppose, of similar accounts or things that you point to. On that, would you like to share any particular poem from the book with us? Did you have a favorite?
Do I have a favorite?
I know that's probably like asking for your favorite kid, but I mean, we shared in our chat a little while ago the tale of Boomer and Chen.
Yeah,
I think that always gets a bit of a...
That's definitely the most popular.
Really? Okay. I feel bad now. If you want to pick something else, please don't let us bully you.
No. I'd love to. No, I do like it, but it's like, it's kind of like, you know, the musicians get annoyed at playing their songs they don't want to play.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
And then no one goes to their concerts. Then no one buys tickets.
Yeah, we're just radio head fans here demanding another round of Creep. Cool. Play Creep for us again.
You don't have to read it if you don't want to.
No, I would love to. I like it.
It's such a liar. if you could give it all the author's intonation, you know, your inflection and pauses, just to really bring out the subtle beauties in the work, that'd be greatly appreciated.
Yeah, I will.
All right.
I should point out that this one is pretty obvious in its intent, but most of the book isn't really polemical or propagandistic, I think, or I hope.
No, it's not. I'm definitely putting you on the spot with this. Please, dear listeners, unless you love it, the rest of the book is quite dissimilar. So this is really just me being a bit cheeky and referencing a bit of an in-joke. But I think it's quite funny. And also it does point to part of the cultural landscape at the moment. So
Yeah. And again, I got the idea for this from my own experience, not in my own family, but and actually I'm not sure that this happened, but I met a couple like this, and I just sort of extrapolated from, you know, what would happen when the husband died. And anyway, so this is called the Tale of Boomer and Chen. And Chen, actually, I found out, is not really a Han Chinese name. It's more Hong Kong or Taiwanese, I think.
Right. Okay.
So anyway, I wasn't aware of that at the time. But now I know. So the Tale of Boomer and Chen. So of all the sights in all the world beheld by men, the saddest is the Boomer with his third wife, Chen. Why, you ask? Does not love, like hope, spring eternal? How then do you say that this couple is so infernal? True, boomers are men, with men's needs to meet. The boomer is not begrudged his unearned treat. But in his manhood, he is half-formed, concupiscent, complacent, content to live on four houses' rent. To not die alone, he obliterates the past, takes a third vow, boasts of his tolerance, and of being of the now. To appease his Chen and assuage his silent fear, he pulls rank on managerial mates to bring her parents here. As he dies, he reassures his kids. I did all I wanted. no regrets. My curved TV, my yacht, my schnapps, my yearly trips to San Moritz. His half-orphaned children listen to the will with Chen and learn their land now belongs to foreign legal kin. Their hope for help with debt, a proper holiday, or second child has passed to Chen, the ruthless and unbeguiled. The boomers' children make a show of happiness and call their infant home on birthdays and Christmas. But Chen is too engrossed in forms, processing fees, residency requirements, and taxes to shoot the breeze. My sadness and my lesson should by now be clear. Chen's new husband and their cousins are the new rentiers. To pass on means, children need the same genes, but property and shares follow different schemes. So weep for the boomer and his third wife, Chen. It is the saddest sight now known to men.
Bravo. Yeah.
Yep.
Excellent getting a live reading of that. Thank you. Thanks for playing Stay Away for us just one last time. That's great.
Yeah.
So I think that.
Yeah.
So, no, go on.
Oh, no, you guys. That's pretty straightforward. That one.
Yeah. Yeah. But the turn of phrase towards the end there, I really think it's fantastic. You know, my sadness and my lesson should by now be clear. Chan's new husband and their cousins are the new rentiers. To pass on memes, children need the same genes, but property and shares follow different schemes. That's pretty much, yeah, that's a incredibly common talking point and theme that I'm sure plenty of people would be aware of. Definitely listening to this show. But yeah, you really put your finger on it. I don't think there's any shame in using perhaps a little bit less coded language to get about it. Yeah. So where can people find you now, mate? What, is there anything you're currently working on? Is there anything else you'd like to promote?
Not especially. I mean, my Twitter, I guess, at, natlucas1788. I'm not really, well, I'm still writing, but I'm not, I did have a couple of poems in the November issue.
Oh, cool.
Which, I'm sure people are aware, they're actually in the book.
Just for sake of completeness, Quadrant is Quadrant Magazine, is that right? The,
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the Australian magazine, yeah.
So where can people pick that up?
Most news agents should have it, actually.
Okay.
If they're in normal areas, I reckon probably some of the hipster areas might not have it. But if they're run by Chinese or Indians, they'll probably have it because they don't know what it is.
I've picked it up myself in the past, but I'll definitely pick up this latest issue for it. It is something you can just generally get in news agents, but they are also available online. Is that right?
Yeah. You know, I don't know. It's definitely paywalled. I think, okay. Yeah, I think it is available online, but it's definitely paywalled.
Yeah.
And you know, Quadrant is they're moving, they're changing a bit. I mean, sometimes you read things like they'll publish like Frank Salter, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, they're not entirely entirely a boomer publication anymore. I don't think.
Well, they just published you, so.
Yeah, well, I don't think they really knew. I don't think he really knew
right.
Who I was.
Okay.
I highly doubt it. He would have known. But, so it's worth reading anyway, the whole magazine.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm still writing. I'm not really doing much at the moment publicly, but the book is available on Amazon. If we meet in person, I'll happily sign a copy.
Oh, I'd appreciate that.
Yeah. But Twitter is probably the best place to find me. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's where we connected. Twitter's pretty great for stuff like that. You know, as I mentioned, we spotted the Owned It Space poem and it all kind of went from there.
Yeah.
So that's at natlucas1788 and the latest issue of Quadrant. So the book again is called For
November
My
issue.
On November issue
of Quadrant, yeah.
Gotcha. And the book again, is called For My People. So it's available on Amazon, and I thoroughly recommend that all of our listeners and anyone else you can convince should pick up a copy of that one. So thank you so much for sharing your time with us, and hopefully we'll catch you again on the show sometime.
Yeah, no worries. I'd love it. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.